Yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
Bananas today. Big blue skulls, hot dogs, big blue blood. Let's make it a blue evil.
Welcome to Farce Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
I'm Ben.
I'm Pete.
And welcome back to The Henson Perspective, where today we're talking about the 45th anniversary of the episode starring Don Knotts, which was recorded between May 23rd and 25th of 1977, the first production episode of the second season, but aired on November 28th, 1997. It's true. My brain was saying something along the lines of, can I formulate a sentence in terms of, this is so far our longest gap between production and air date, and that would have been even longer if it lasted until Muppets Tonight before they aired it.
Also, we wouldn't be covering this episode because this would only be the 25th anniversary instead of the 45th anniversary.
It's true. As we look back at the last 50 years of comedy, this would technically qualify as being somewhere within that time, but wouldn't necessarily be an anniversary worth speaking of. Don Knotts comes onto the show at the beginning. He's the first guest that they get in terms of production. They do not air him first. I don't know if that says anything particularly about his star power. We will talk about his reputation and his standing later in the episode. But first, we should probably talk about the structure of this episode.
We're going to talk about the not guest stuff or runner stuff. We're going to talk about the separates.
What you have been struggling to find a term for that doesn't make it sound like the stuff that's not important in the show.
Yes, because it's not that it's not important. It's just...
it's the disconnected parts.
Yeah. The remainders is harsh.
That's what we've been sort of defaulting to accidentally. How about the ancillary sketches? The adjunct sketches?
Yeah, I'm fine with both of those. I'll forget that that's where we're going to call them, and I will default to remainders. But
excellent. So we're going to talk about those sketches that aren't integral to either the guest star or the backstage runner first. Then we're going to have a little quizzy about Don Knotts. And then we will swing back around to talking about all of his and the backstage segments as a lump, before then talking about any statistics that have accrued over the episode and our five favorite moments to round it off.
So let's start with the opening.
The first musical number comes on right after...
Why do you insist on skipping the opening?
Because the opening is...
Statler and Waldorf running to their seats.
I think of the title sequence as not the opening. I think of the backstage segment with Scooter as the opening. And then I think of the closing of the opening as being the titles. And therefore, everything that happens before the first ad break, I think of as a unit. And then the beginning of the show happens with Kermit or anybody else coming in front of the curtain after the first ad break.
Yeah, but it doesn't have anything to do with Don Knotts.
But Don Knotts has to do with the actual pre-curtain opening. And then I think Kermit says the name of the guest. I think of that all as a thing that has to do with the guest.
Yeah, I think I don't because it's so rare that he does anything different that I'm just like, eh.
I agree. So, yes, we can talk about the two variant segments of the title sequence now, if you'd like.
I mean, they're not integral to Don Knotts.
Fair enough. In fact, the Statler and Waldorf segment is not integral to anything.
Nope. I do... See, this is where I wish this was the first episode aired, because they're running to their seats wordlessly. They don't say anything, hence wordlessly. And so as a first episode after a break, I really like that idea of, oh, we haven't done this in 8 months. We're running late. And also there's only one chair. And it's never addressed why there's not a chair there.
I didn't notice that.
Yeah. Yeah. Only Waldorf's chair is there. Statler's chair is just
invisible.
Yep.
We could jump ahead now because I also feel like the final moment after the closing credits has a similar relationship to this is the first episode of the season. Not only are they running late to get to the show in the very beginning, but at the end, they make a resolution to stick around and watch the rest of the season.
Yeah.
The joke back and forth is complaining about how awful the show is. Statler starts by saying the show is awful.
Terrible.
Disgusting.
See you next week.
Of course, Statler closes. And so that really is good bookends of their inexplicably rushing to make it to the show, a thing that we assume they hate.
Mm-hmm.
But the end, their masochistic relationship with the show is confirmed.
I also, referring to another podcast, really enjoyed them saying see you next week, just like our friends Mike and Tom do when they eat snacks.
Gonzo's bit, again, this is the first production episode, apparently is the same bit that shows up in the Teresa Brewer episode.
It's not.
It's not.
Because in this one, he shoots fire only once.
Okay.
And says sorry once.
Sorry.
Where in the Teresa Brewer episode, he goes, sorry, sorry.
Okay.
So I also wish that those two episodes were swapped, because having him say sorry only once right after we saw him saying sorry twice is a downgrade. Especially when that second sorry is priceless.
And so, therefore, unlike the first season, we have seen zero repeats of a Gonzo bit. Now, almost halfway through the season.
I feel like there has been one.
No, we've had three... Three different colored smokes. We've had two fires. We've had two different kinds of balloons.
Mm-hmm.
Also different colors. We've had two different gunshots, but not the same.
I think I may have read that there's going to be one that's reused, okay. And I'm not sure when it happens then.
Stay tuned, eager listeners, for eventually when we discover when they've run out of stuff. After the ad break from the cold open, we then have Kermit in front of the curtain.
I also noticed Kermit's arms were extra wiggly in this intro. Wrote that down as a note.
Introducing our guest, but first, a ginger-flavored opening number. And I wasn't sure if this was going to be... I had two guesses. This was either going to be taking place in a gingerbread house, or it was going to be redheads.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wrong about both of them.
Yeah, but you aren't far wrong.
The song is called Sweet Gingerbread Man. Pete, did you recognize this song?
No.
This song has a 1972 recording that was done by Sammy Davis Jr. that was used in the closing credits of the third episode of Hawkeye.
Oh, okay.
As one of their many holiday-themed songs that they filled out the season with.
Well, I watched that once over a year ago.
Has it been that long?
It came out last Christmas.
I remember that particular music cue being a great vibey bit, as they chose lots of different fun holiday music, and that one was exciting and unexpected. The song itself is from a 1970 film called The Magic Garden of Stanley Sweetheart, which was the film debut appearance of Don Johnson.
Oh.
And was roundly trashed by critics as saying that it was a shameless attempt at capitalizing on youth hippie culture, trying to get them to go to the movies. And yet Andy Warhol defended it, according to Wikipedia.
Feel like I'm made out of gingerbread.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Crumb picking, lip licking gingerbread.
I found the song to be fairly charming. Unfortunately, this sketch has very little going for it, and their particular rendition of the song is a little more flat than the Sammy Davis Jr. version.
Well, gingerbread cookies are traditionally flat cookies.
And they're very flat in this particular episode, because the song ends with four gingerbread men lining up behind each other so that they can fall backwards into one flat cookie.
Hey, Ben?
Yeah.
I liked this.
Well, tell me why, because I will say also, this song, the way it was presented, made me think about other musical numbers that we've seen and reevaluate them, because this is one of the least puppeteered musical numbers we've seen, I thought, and then I realized that's not true. In fact, we've had a bunch of musical numbers with effectively dancers in Muppet costumes. It's just that because these Muppet costumes were fabricated specifically for this musical number and didn't look like, for example, the Muppet men that Sandy Duncan danced with, the Mutations.
There was nothing Muppet about these.
Basically, yes.
They were gingerbread men.
And so that made me go, this is basically just a dance recital.
Yes. Agreed. But I liked the choreography. I thought it was fun. I couldn't stop watching the second gingerbread man from the left. He was doing some stuff that was like either slightly more embellished than the rest of them or was like slightly off time that I couldn't pay attention to any of the rest of them. I knew there were other three others on there. Was just watching that one.
He was the left shark of the gingerbread men?
Yeah, the second left shark. Yeah, I was really surprised at how much I enjoyed this based off of my usual hatred of musical numbers.
I think I just wished that, because in front of the four dancers in the foreground, there is a gingerbread man puppet whose mouth moves, unlike the mouth of the dancers, who have a voiceover sing-along with the chorus, but their mouths don't actually move in time with it. We're just supposed to intuit that they're singing based on camera work. I understand the practicality of having a puppet in the foreground be on a different plane than the dancers. But their total lack of interaction, I found distracting in terms of saying, I wish this had been more participatory somehow between traditional Muppets and the Muppet dancers.
I think I was also shocked at how good dancers Jim, Jerry, Richard, and Dave were.
Those are the people who are in the suits.
I just looked it up, and it's Frank is credited as lead gingerbread man.
That I also was surprised by. His voice is very unlike most Frank voices. I could tell it was Frank, but he's doing something beyond his normal range.
In the notes field of the Wikia, it says that this sketch is the only song in the series in which Frank Oz is given the lead vocal on a song not sung by one of his regulars. Again, getting back to the point I was saying.
I think it's a fun song, so I'm not at all surprised that somebody would enjoy it, and the fact that you said you found the choreography engaging, that's more than I found, but that's great.
And like I said, impressive for four people who I don't consider to be dancers to do that well with it.
Okay.
All right. There is a Statler and Waldorf section after
Sweet Gingerbread Man.
Yeah. Statler says, I know what's wrong with the show.
Waldorf. It's the theater, he says.
Yeah. And then Waldorf says, what's wrong with it?
Statler says, the seats face the stage.
Yep. Which makes me think that Statler and Waldorf would love the Wilbur Theater.
It's true. They could pay Bill Blumenreich's terrible bar prices and face each other and ignore the stage. The next segment that doesn't have anything to do with the runners is the next musical number, which is introduced by Kermit and Fozzie. The runner that we're not talking about until later is that Kermit and Fozzie are collaborating on the setup of the episode. They don't use the word bits, they say parts. They've worked out different parts for the show. And they introduce the next number, which is Windmills of Your Mind, done by a Muppet that has a very bizarre name in the Wikia.
Yes, the Screaming Thing.
Yeah, not the Screaming Thing Muppet, the Screaming Thing. Quite an extraordinary reduction of their role.
Yeah.
Considering that this Muppet plays an entire song and then shows up later in Vet's Hospital because of a very particular mechanical aspect of it, and yet is reduced to just the concept of the button of this sketch.
Mm-hmm. Also, going back to the intro for a minute.
Yeah.
There's a future reference in that intro.
Which is?
I believe Fozzie says, moving right along.
Go ahead, make your introduction.
Oh, okay. Moving right along.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, I wonder if they were in the process of writing that at this moment.
Huh.
Comes out in 79, right?
Yeah. We talked about earlier that the Brian J. Jones biography of Jim Henson talks that they were in pre-production of it prior to the filming of the season, that they were trying to figure out what the story would be. They were trying to break the movie. Wild speculation.
Yeah.
It's not an impossible thought process that they could have had that phrase locked.
Or that they said it here and it that inspired something. It. Yeah.
Windmills of Your Mind is an Oscar-winning song. It came out in the soundtrack to The Thomas Crown Affair in 1968 and was written by the exact same team that produced Sweet Gingerbread Man. The music is by Michel Legrand, and the lyrics are by Alan and Marilyn Bergman. And your aunt hates this song.
I don't know how I knew this song. Like, unlike what we talked about with the Sweet Gingerbread Man, mm-hmm. where you were like, oh, you've heard this song before. And I was like, I don't know. I have heard this song before.
Dusty Springfield covered this song in 1969, and it is a supermarket Muzak classic.
Mm.
And that's one of the reasons why your aunt hates it so much, is she has heard it since 1968, and it won an award for large portions of time, and just thinks it's insipid, boring, and overplayed.
Well, has she then seen this version? Because this version is interesting.
It's pretty much two jokes. The sequence starts with our screaming Muppet saying...
A thing, Ben. A screaming thing.
I refuse to depersonalize it in that way.
Hey, its name is Screaming Thing.
Its assignation by a Wikia is Screaming Thing. Who knows what the Hensons called it?
Next thing I know, you're going to start referring to that rock superhero not by his name just because you don't like calling things thing.
I'm going to call him by his name, which is Benjamin Grimm. I'm going to treat him with respect.
He'll always be the thing to me.
The premise of the sketch is that the screaming thing is saying to the camera and the audience that on the outside he's very calm, but on the inside he is a whirl of anxiety. And this is manifested by the camera zooming in on its eyeball, and then it's revealed that he is running in a landscape with a wheel of legs, which is basically three limbs creating the visual effect of the kind of Scooby-Doo running, Fred Flintstone swirling of legs that you get. There's really interesting stuff being done here in order to hide both the fact that the background is moving and the puppeteer would be kind of in sight. So they've got a filter on the lens and they've got very interesting lighting to mask the effect.
And also it has a second arm that's trailing behind it too, wavering. So that's being puppeteered as well.
Right. While also keeping the whirling legs mechanism and the puppet head in plain view. And then the lyrics are the marvelously deeply weird Thomas Crown lyrics of somebody, as been described by, I don't remember who said that, somebody who just looked up circle in the thesaurus and came up with everything. It's a circle in a spiral, it's a wheel within a wheel, never ending nor beginning in an ever-spinning reel, like a snowball down a mountain in a carnival balloon,
or like a carousel that's turning, running rings around the moon, cause like a clock whose hands are sweeping past the minutes of its facey, that the world is like an apple whirling silently in space,
etc. Et
I'm impressed that you he was not reading. That was from memory.
I love this soundtrack. I think the Michel Legrand soundtrack to the Thomas Crown Affair is one of the best soundtracks ever made, and that song on it is great.
You hear that, Aunt Meg? Back to being number one favorite nephew.
Then after the tempo increases and the verses get more manic, the screaming thing runs into a windmill itself, and the camera zooms back out from the scene and the eye, and then the screaming thing is shaking, quivering madly, and then repeats, on the outside, I'm very calm, but is unable to maintain the pretense anymore and runs screaming towards the camera.
Mm-hmm. Ben, we've talked about this before. When it runs into the windmill, is that a hit?
No.
Hits the windmill.
No.
Okay. One fewer hit tallied.
So you thought it was.
I logged it. I was being safe.
There is a Statler and Waldorf response to this as well.
Yes, which brings up some controversy.
Okay.
Because Statler starts by saying, how do you like that opening number?
And Waldorf says, I didn't even notice it.
And Statler says, didn't notice it? How is that possible? It was loud and raucous with a screaming thing, running amok. How could you not notice it?
And Waldorf says, well, next time I'll try to be more observant.
And then the screaming thing runs into their box, jumps over the ledge. And Statler then says, would you do that, please? And then they both look over the ledge, confused as to what just happened.
I disagree with both your line reading and your assessment of the ending.
Well, I agree with your line reading comment because it's been over a week since I watched that, so I don't remember.
You said, would you do that, please?
Mm-hmm.
The way you said it just now made it to my ears sound like you were saying, would you also jump over the ledge?
Yes.
I think that the joke of this is that neither Statler nor Waldorf is noticing the screaming thing run between them.
Oh.
When he's saying, would you do that? He's saying, would you be more observant in the future? The joke being that he is also being unobservant.
Yep.
How could you not notice it?
Well, in the future, I'll try to be more observant.
Could you do that, please?
That is totally accurate. I remember that now, and also the last line of my notes are saying that the first time I watched it, I didn't understand what the joke was either, and it was the second time I was like, oh, they didn't see it. So, again, if I was more observant, I would have reminded myself what happened.
Would you do that, please?
No.
But let's talk about the Wikia in this sketch describes the fact that it runs and falls out of the balcony.
Yeah, no, it jumps.
Yeah, this is a screaming thing that is so upset by its earlier inner turmoil that it is jumping to its death.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is a suicide attempt.
And I thought that any minimization of that, and it was... I don't want to use the word disrespectful, but inaccurate too. I think they're just making a joke about killing itself and minimizing it only by the traditional Muppet crash of pots and pans.
Yep.
The next segment that doesn't have anything to do with the runner or the backstage
is Vet's Hospital.
Which begins with, over the voiceover narration, Piggy checking out her reflection in the head mirror, the traditional reflector worn by people who are dressing up as a doctor and need a prop.
Yeah, I've never understood what the purpose of that mirror is.
Oh, I can tell you.
Okay.
It's so that a doctor can redirect overhead lighting using a reflective disc in order to shine light at something they're looking at, usually inside a mouth or some sort of head cavity. When you didn't have very tiny, small battery-powered lights.
Or those flexible arm lamps.
Yep. You would use the ambient light and focus direct it using that mirror.
Which makes sense why I haven't seen one in the last 25 years.
That's right.
Okay. But yeah, Piggy is using that as a compact mirror.
At which point she notices that she's being observed and drops it and hurries into place as usual.
Animal watch for the patient?
Well, we've been very clear that this is a thing.
Yes, it's not an animal, because it's...
It is a noun. It is a person, place, or...
Thing, because it's a screaming thing. Screaming thing is back, baby! Did not die in its attempt.
But its injuries sustained from its fall don't seem to be the thing, no pun intended, that Dr. Bob thinks is wrong with the patient.
Nope, because he's a bad doctor. Although, going back to Animal Watch,
yeah.
Later in the sketch, Dr. Bob does refer to the screaming thing as a bird.
That's correct.
So maybe it is an animal. It doesn't look like a bird to me.
Like it, most it Muppets, it has feathers.
Yeah.
Feather hair.
But no wings.
It has a beaky front face.
But not a beak.
In that, unlike, say, a duck or a chicken, it doesn't have a distinct material difference from its protruding snout.
But unlike Dr. Bob, I'm not a veterinarian, so...
Are we sure that Dr. Bob's a veterinarian?
I mean, he works at Veterinarian's Hospital.
And he is a doctor, but in what? He could have a PhD.
True. It's third wild speculation.
In just the ancillary material segment. Upon asking the question, what seems to be the problem with this patient, Nurse Janet says, I think he has flat feet.
And then we get a whole bunch of feet-leg running jokes.
Because, fascinatingly enough, the three-foot wheel that's on the side of this patient in the earlier sketch felt like it was a thing that was designed to create the illusion of movement, but wouldn't have been real. And yet in this sketch, they're just like, nope, this is a being that has three legs on one side of its body and no legs on the other side of its body. And that's all just its Kuzbanian biology.
Mm-hmm.
They don't bring up Kuzbane, but it has that level of, yeah, sounds normal.
Mm-hmm.
And they just accept the weird reality of it has three spinning legs on one side, and that's what they run with for the course of this episode.
Looks more like a flat tire to me.
I think it's a case of three left feet.
Three feet, Dr. Bob. What do you make of that?
Oh, about a yard.
A lot of foot jokes.
Does that make this the internet's favorite sketch of all Muppet shows?
There aren't any lingering close-ups.
It's true.
It's not like Mississippi Mud, which I think is probably the most feet-centric Muppet sketch I can think of.
Yeah.
But speaking of callbacks, we've had two vets hospitals so far that have employed a badumpchi, that have used the comedy snare, and it's used twice in this sketch.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, there are lots of jokes where it's not done, but there are two focal points where they employ it. And it doesn't seem to be used consistently in Vets Hospital. It was used way back when,
mm-hmm.
when Fozzie was first on the table and did the wiggling ears, and they would all look to camera and do the jokes. This, therefore, the first episode of the second season, they use it consistently within the logic of the sketch, but not persistently throughout the sketch. It is then used in one other sketch we've covered so far this season, but there have been lots of Vets Hospitals this season, and it hasn't been used throughout. So this is a transitional vestige of the sketch.
Hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Also, Dr. Bob hits the screaming thing twice. Because in his revelry at the jokes, mm-hmm. he
smacks
it.
Instead of slapping his thigh, he's slapping the patient.
Yeah, but they're forceful enough to count as hits.
The foot jokes turn into measurement jokes
mm-hmm.
because he says, well, he's got 3 feet. What does that mean? Well, it's about a yard. And then they work out a way of saying that he could have had 6 feet, which is a fathom, if you're measuring depth instead of length. And then at the end of that, the voice comes on to say that Dr. Bob has performed a medical feat. Tune in next week when you hear Nurse Piggy ask if they should call in a specialist.
Yeah, not really. Not really a foot joke there.
No, because the foot joke at the end is Dr. Bob says, no, just call in a tow truck.
That's right.
Which the DVD subtitles spelled like a normal tow truck. They didn't emphasize the pun. One of several subtitle screw-ups in this episode.
Yeah, since you brought up the subtitles, I did have to watch the DVD, mm-hmm. which we'll get into later.
Mm-hmm.
In the Windmills of Your Mind, Disney Plus had it all captioned.
Right. Yep.
But the DVD just said, accelerated singing.
That's funny. I like that. If all goes according to plans, I'll have two more pieces of shade about the subtitles before we get through the episode. After Vets Hospital is the traditional fade to black, and we come back to the UK spot, which is a classic music hall song from 1914 called I'm Burlington Bertie from Bow.
My pose, though ironical, shows that my monocle holds up my face, keeps it in place, stops it from slipping away.
Do you remember this character, Pete?
Uh-oh.
This character showed up in the Nancy Walker episode and sang My Old Dutch. And okay. At the time, you said, this character is called Burlington Birdie. Well, now we know why.
All right.
Because the lyrics of this song are him saying, I'm Burlington Birdie. The lyrics of this were virtually inaudible.
Oh, really?
In my opinion, yes. This is a... Jerry Nelson is a great puppeteer and a great voice actor, but his singing sometimes, when he's doing a voice, reduces his articulation, in my opinion. And I found this to be, because of the fake British accent, not unlike my criticism of My Old Dutch, I needed to read the lyrics while listening to it in order to understand what he was saying.
Interesting. Since I'm a subtitles on all the time kind of guy, didn't notice
you just followed along because you were able to process the words as they happened.
Yeah.
And because you were watching on Disney Plus, you could see the lyrics.
Mm-hmm. Very true. Because yeah, my notes on this are good wordplay. And and I really liked the vocal patterns. He does some really, really interesting, maybe it's the way it's written.
Yes, the way the lines and lyrics are broken up are very clever.
Yeah. And there's pauses in the beginnings of lines because of the way those vocal patterns work. I really enjoyed this, despite it being boring.
Yes, it is one of the least... We talk all the time about the fact that the UK spots are probably designed to be low production. This has, aside from the creation of a brand new aged British whatnot Muppet to be Burlington Birdie, who then comes back for one episode and is never seen again, according to the fandom page. This was pretty low rent in terms of what they needed to do to accomplish it.
Well, in the grand scheme of Pete not enjoying UK spots, this one does pretty good.
Yeah, I'm shocked. The next segment continues on with the ongoing theme, and from that, we cut into Rolf in another heavy filter, not unlike the Windmills of Your Mind, but a different gauzy, hazy vibe.
Yeah, this seems like a 1970s grease on the camera lens of a potential pornographic movie filter.
I was going more with baby photos in a Sears studio.
I mean, that's definitely the vibe they're going for, but...
Because the image is Rolf cradling the head of a puppy.
Yeah.
A puppy whose eyes are still not quite ready to be opened. Although it's a big puppy.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess let's get into this.
Yeah.
I'm fairly certain this dog has been placed into a medical coma.
You think this is an older dog that they've just doped up?
Yeah. Because even a newborn puppy wouldn't sit through that sleepily the way
however many Rolf takes.
And the way Rolf pets that puppy. Rolf opens that dog's eyes with how hard he pets that dog.
It's true. I when I was talking about the closed eyes, I figured we would eventually need to get into the fact that we do see the dark black of the dog's eyes at some point. Because, yeah, as you say, Rolf pets his forehead and pulls back the large extra skin flaps of dog in order to show the eyes.
Rolf dog handles that dog. It is disturbing.
Huh.
And it turned me... I mean, I don't really like this song anyway, even though it was written by our previous guest's husband. I remembered something, Ben.
Congratulations.
But yeah, I was just so put off by this whole segment.
I hear puppies cry. I watch you grow. Why, you'll learn much more than I'll ever know.
That's fascinating to me.
Dog is cute, though.
See, that's the part I can't connect to, because I have, as I've described to other people, an agnostic response to dogs, which is that when somebody shows me a photograph of a cute dog, the most my brain can do is say, yep, that's a picture of a dog. And that was my emotional reaction to this sketch, was I'm supposed to be moved and to care by the romantic puppy imagery here, but I was just like, this is a song that I like, and that is a face of a dog. Check.
I mean, it's not the cutest dog I've ever seen. I didn't get the traditional cute aggression that I get. I did not ever want to hurt that dog, which I wouldn't ever hurt a dog. But sometimes when I see a cute dog, I want to just squish it. It's a thing.
I thought that I was going to be the villain of this conversation, but thank you for taking that torch back from me.
You're welcome. Cute aggression. Google it, listeners. I've got it.
Yep, that's much worse than dog agnosticism.
Is it, though? Because at least I have an emotional response to dogs. You just go, dog.
Yeah, that sounds sane to me. It's not like I want to mangle you with my love, Charles Manson.
I prefer Lenny.
And I will love him and pet him and squeeze him and hug him and call him George.
Exactly. That's me.
All right.
I'll hug it till it doesn't breathe anymore.
After that, we have another backstage bit, and then we have the Swedish chef doing fishy chowder.
I really like the chef using the ladle as a guitar.
I thought that was brilliant. A great piece of physical improv. I really liked the fact that he flings the ladle behind him and whangs a cupboard full of decorative dishes with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, while his head looks back to check, his hands grip the edge of the giant bowl in a way that very clearly says one of two things. A, those are two different puppeteers. B, perhaps you needed to stabilize that puppet in order for one arm to twist the head around and the other arms to stay, keep the body in place so that it wasn't too yanked out of place for mm-hmm. it. But the main feature of this sketch is the giant steel tureen in front of the Swedish chef, which he is putting a weird rubbery orange dead fish into.
Live fish?
Well, when he first puts it in there, he's holding it upside down, and it is non-responsive in any way. It's not wiggling, it's not unhappy to be out of water, it is dead, dead, dead. However,
or drugged like a dog.
A turn of phrase that I hope does not become normalized. Yeah, well, the fish is a very strange thing in its introduction, specifically the way he's holding it and the way he drops it into the bowl. But then, after adding lemons and some greens to the dish and starting to sprinkle salt into the tureen, that seems to revitalize this fish, which then begins attacking the pepper shaker that the salt is coming out of. That's very clearly a pepper grinder.
Yep.
But the Swedish chef is very clearly saying salt. And it becomes a struggle of wills and violence between the fish in the tureen, which also has been put, scales and all, into this cookery pot, which is not generally how one prepares fish.
Untrue. Lots of fish get cooked with scales on.
How many?
Lots.
Cite your sources, Wikipedia.
In the latest Doughboys episode, they talk about getting I forget what the dish is called, but at many Italian restaurants, you can just get a whole fish.
I'm aware of this as a phenomenon.
All I'm saying is you said that doesn't happen. And yet now you're saying you're aware of this phenomenon. Which is it, Ben? It does happen or it doesn't happen?
It doesn't happen in soup. Baked fish on a platter, yes, sometimes.
I got nothing.
As somebody who's not an especial seafood person, there may be, listeners, write in with your refutations, but it is wholly outside my experience to have fish in stew that are whole, unscaled, unboned fish.
You're probably right about that.
I bet sardines proved me wrong.
Oh yeah, for sure. But a fish of that size, mm-hmm. I bet you're largely right on. Mm-hmm. So when the fish and the Swedish chef are fighting,
yes,
I only counted one actual hit.
Okay.
There's lots of near misses and there's lots of grazing, but I only could see one solid slap. Connection.
Yeah.
So I only counted one hit.
Because the Swedish chef, in trying to fend off the fish from...
Trying to escape.
Trying or eat, is the vague sense, is that having been revitalized by lemon and the salt...
I didn't get that it was trying to eat the pepper or salt that coming out of the grinder.
Uh-huh.
Ah, interesting.
And then like it that. Tries to eat and or steal the spoon, and then when the Swedish chef leans over the tureen, you get the sense that it's trying to eat or attack his face, which he then responds to by yelping and struggling and then coming up. And acting as if he has eaten the fish by doing a chef's kiss sort of gesture.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's revealed that the fish is still in the tureen. I really wish they hadn't undercut that final moment.
Like, yeah.
It only makes sense as action of the fish attacks his face and he has to eat it to survive. Otherwise, what is he doing in terms of the tastes great gesture?
Well, because
he drank the broth?
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. Because the fish does, like, get... Maybe it bites him and drags him into the tureen. And then in doing that, he drank some broth and the broth tastes great. I don't like it as much either. I think if he ate the fish, we never saw the fish again is a better ending.
But we have established previously that the engine of the Swedish chef's sketches is that the Swedish chef tries to make something, the food rebels, the food wins.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can't off the top of my dome think of a bit where he wins.
Yeah. Yeah, this is probably the closest to a win he gets.
Except that it's sort of status quo.
Yeah.
He slaps the fish around a lot, and then after the fish mugs for camera, he then, again, pushes it back down, and that's the end of the sketch. Sort of half a concept,
yeah.
And not really executed with a finale.
Yeah.
You said you really liked this. That's only why I'm being critical.
I think I really liked the chef playing a little like a guitar.
Okay.
And other than that, it's a Swedish Chef thing, so yes, I'm going to like it. But I wouldn't count it as one of my favorites.
Fair. I also wouldn't count it as one of the good descriptions of the subtitles.
Oh.
Which starts off by saying in square brackets, sings in mock Swedish.
Mm-hmm.
But then as he continues to speak in mock Swedish, the subtitles say that he is mumbling.
Yeah, he's not mumbling.
No. Is that what other tongues are to you, subtitles? They're just mumbles.
You would have preferred that subtitle description being in Burlington Birdie, because for you, he was mumbling.
Fair. I agree with that entirely.
After that, Statler and Waldorf have some things to say.
Mm-hmm.
Waldorf is groaning in pain.
Statler asks, what's the matter with him?
Waldorf says, it's either the show or indigestion. I hope it's indigestion.
Statler asks why.
It'll get better in a little while.
But paired with the idea of the what we talked about as the intro and closing of Statler and Waldorf,
mm-hmm.
that they're eager to get here, and they're going to subject themselves to how awful it is on purpose. I like the fact that the fatalism in this central bit is, this will never get better.
Nope. And it makes my stomach hurt.
See you again next week.
Sure thing. So speaking of seeing you next week, that's it for the ancillary parts. I remembered, Ben.
Not bad.
Next week, we'll see. You.
So, in order to talk about the rest of the show, first we have to talk about our guest and provide Pete with a little context as to what he should know about Don Knotts. I've prepared 5 questions for you. Question number 1. I'm going to read you 2 biographical statements. Born in 1916 in Boston to Nathan and Phoebe, Jewish-German immigrants from Prussia, he was forced to leave school to help their parents earn money during the Great Depression when their store closed. Born in July 1925 in West Virginia to parents William and Elise, who lost their farm in the Great Depression just after the crash of 1929. He tried to help keep up their expenses by doing a paper route. 2 very parallel narratives. One of those is about Don Knotts. The other is about William Rosenberg, founder of Dunkin' Donuts.
Don't do my bits at me. Also, very good.
Or is about a third person that just had a depression spin narrative. Which of those 2, or neither, is about Don Knotts?
I'm going to go B is about Don Knotts. It doesn't sound like a Bostonian to me.
No.
And I know the first Dunkin' Donuts was in Quincy, Massachusetts.
Yeah, that was the getaway.
Thanks, Mike Mitchell.
Question number 2. The following statement is about one of 2 people. His older cousin was an artist who made puppets, and he gave one with a corncob pipe and a straw hat to him, which he used to develop a hayseed character, which he then used in his early comedy routines. Was that about A, Edgar Bergen in 1919, about the creation of Mortimer Sturge, or was that about B, Don Knotts, who did puppeteering work as part of his comedy shtick, or C, about neither of them?
Oh, no. So, my instinct was to say Don Knotts because of his other characters that I vaguely know about. But as I was saying that, you saying Edgar Bergen, then you go, oh, I did research on him, and that story sounds familiar. But I'm gonna stick with Don Knotts.
Correct. Edgar Bergen's early puppet was carved by a Chicago wood carver based on an Irish newspaper boy that turned into Charlie McCarthy.
Yeah.
And Knotts continued to use his puppet in early ventriloquist acts, which when he enlisted in the army at age 19 in 1943 or 1944, he then toured the Pacific with a comedy bit in order to boost morale called Stars and Gripes,
He used the puppet for most of that act, but got so frustrated and irritated with the puppet act that he accidentally had it wash overboard on one of the ships and had to therefore work out new material without the ventriloquist bit as a crutch.
So he had a gripe with his own act.
He did. Question number three. Knotts would have recorded this episode between completion of filming and the theatrical release of Herbie Goes to Monte Carlo, which premiered in the U.S. in June of 1977, the third in the Herbie the Love Bug series. Knotts, prior to that point, had been in a series of bizarrely titled comedies, including The Last Time I Saw Archie, The Incredible Mr. Limpet, and The Ghost and Mrs. Chicken. But had basically solidified his work as a nervous, scared character. In 1978, just after this, he would appear in one of the following three films. A. Hot Lead and Cold Feet, a Disney Western starring Jim Dale, where he played the cowardly sheriff. B. The Madcap Adventures of Mr. Toad, the Disney adaptation of The Wind in the Willows, where he played J. Thaddeus Toad. Or C. The Bad News Bears Go to Japan, the sequel to The Bad News and Bears featuring Jackie Earle Haley and Walter Matthau, where he plays Marvin Lazar, a small-time agent hustler trying to capitalize on the Bears' reputation, named after Irving Lazar, previously of this parish.
May I ask a clarification question?
Yeah.
Are all three of these real but may not have actually happened in 78, because that's the question that you're asking?
No, they all happened in 1978, and they're all real, and only one of them features Don Knotts.
Okay.
A, correct? Hot Lead and Cold Feet, a Disney Western where he is the sheriff, is a real thing.
That's why I asked that clarification, because yeah. I knew I can see him in that role. I've never seen it, but like I'm fairly certain that's one of the famous images of Don Knotts. I can just picture him with a cowboy hat in that setting.
Fine. Question number four. In addition to his role in The Andy Griffith Show, Knotts is probably best known for his role as the landlord in Three's Company. Which is true about the timing of that role with regard to his appearance on The Muppet Show? A. Knotts was in the second of the two unaired pilots that were filmed in 1976 as an attempt to work out the kinks of adapting the original British series. Because of his commitment to being in Herbie and Monte Carlo, he was unable to continue to be in the series. B. According to his daughter's memoir, Tied Up in Knots, his appearances on The Muppet Show, Donnie and Marie, and the variety show Tony Orlando and Dawn were all part of a media blitz after a period of being in films but wanting to get back into television, which led to him being cast and the start of the second season of the show. Or C. Knotts took over from Mr. Roper in the third episode of the fourth series in September 1979, which had nothing to do with the Muppet Show whatsoever.
See.
Correct.
I know shockingly a lot about Don Knotts despite knowing nothing about Don Knotts. You're just asking questions about things that I happen to have vague knowledge of.
Apparently. As always, we close out the five questions that I ask by talking about Don Knotts' top four best known for on IMDb. And Pete has 60 seconds to try and connect those film roles for which he is best known to Jim Henson based on the cast in those films. Pete, Don Knotts' top four on IMDb are The Andy Griffith Show from 1960, featuring Ron Howard, Andy Griffith, George Lindsay, and Jim Nabors, and is not qualified for this game. Pleasantville from 1998, featuring Tobey Maguire, Jeff Daniels, Joan Allen, William H. Macy, Reese Witherspoon, and others. It's a Mad, 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 Mad World from 1963, featuring Spencer Tracy, Ethel Merman, Milton Berle, Mickey Rooney, Phil Silvers, and Peter Falk, and Carl Reiner. And Three's Company from 1976,
despite the fact that it actually aired in 1977, but is listed as 1976 because of its two failed pilots. Using those two movies and memory of previous episodes, because you were tested earlier on both Milton Berle and Ethel Merman, can you connect Don Knotts to Jim Henson in 60 seconds, starting now?
Hey, Ben. So the same thing just happened to me. Yeah. That's what happened last time. Is you said it's a mad, 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 mad world, and I got so excited, and then immediately went, I don't remember. I know I should remember this, but I don't. Oh no. Because it's... I know I did it last time, but I don't remember if I did. It's Mel Brooks, I think. Oh no, because I'm pretty sure this is exactly what happened last time too, is I was...
20 seconds.
I was wishy-washy on it, and then I said, it's Mel Brooks, and then you said, correct. I think. Maybe not. Oh boy, this memory is becoming an issue for me.
10 seconds.
Mel Brooks.
Mel Brooks is not in Mad Mad Mad.
That's
Mad.
Right, and that's what happened last time. Oh no.
Time.
Yep.
Carl Reiner.
Yep.
Mel Brooks' famous long-term comedy partner appears with Mel Brooks in scandalously few of his movies. But he does appear in History of the World Part 1 with Mel Brooks, and Mel Brooks is in the Muppet movie. Additionally, Carl Reiner is in Ocean's 11 with Elliot Gould, who is in the Muppets movie, and Carl Reiner is in The Jerk with Steve Martin, who's in the Muppet movie. The connection we established with Ethel Merman in the previous season is that Ethel Merman is in Airplane with Leslie Nielsen, who's in Dracula Dead and Loving It with Mel Brooks, who's in the Muppet movie. However, Milton Berle is in the Muppet movie.
Yeah, I don't remember that.
Uncle Milty is the car salesman who works with Sweetums that sells them the big Studebaker.
Yeah, see, I love Sweetums so much as I just focus on Sweetums in that scene.
But also, Peter Falk is in The Great Muppet Caper.
Yeah, but I've never seen that.
Other connections? J.T. Walsh is famously in Pleasantville, and he is in A Few Good Men with Kevin Bacon. Wait, that's not what we're doing. He is in The Russia House with Michelle Pfeiffer. And the one that I thought was particularly amusing was Jeff Daniels is in There Goes the Neighborhood, which is directed by your aunt's college friend, Bill Phillips, with Dabney Coleman, who's in Muppets Take Manhattan.
Very fun. Second Aunt Meg reference in this episode.
Yep. Decided to go all in on Aunt Meg references. Well, Don Knotts is probably one of the most media successful guests that we've had. Like, doesn't feel fringe at all. Feels wildly mainstream and therefore makes sense as a first production guest. And therefore is a little surprising that he's showing up almost halfway through the season. But his sketches are pretty great, except that for the first time ever, we finally have a guest that basically has no musical ability whatsoever. And I'm fascinated with the way in which the show has figured out ways to deal with guests who aren't known for their music before. But we're going wholeheartedly into what do you do with a guest that apparently has no interest in playing the musical variety act game in this episode. So that's all going to come to the conclusion as we talk about the linked runners in this episode, because the backstage runner is all about leading up to the performance of a musical number. And the guests is just doing guest stuff as a fairly traditional sketch comedy guest would be.
Yep.
So I want to look at the way in those two things dovetail together and provide us with an unexpected solution to how do you deal with a non-musical guest in a show that ends in a big musical number.
Now, some of our listeners who don't have the DVDs might be confused right now.
About talking about a big musical number at the end of the episode?
Yeah, because they didn't see it. And all references to that musical number are cut out.
Wait, you're telling me that the backstage runner where Floyd keeps on talking about Lullaby of Birdland aren't in the episode?
In Disney Plus, the words Lullaby and Birdland are never spoken.
Wow, That I didn't know. So here's what happened with me. I watched most of this episode earlier this week. I got up to the Swedish Chef bit and found myself falling asleep and said,
as one would.
All right, I'll finish this later. Downloaded the episode to a flash drive. I have no idea where that flash drive is. And so watched the last bit of the episode on Disney Plus on my computer while at work and noticed that a backstage runner bit had the most violent post-edited fade to black in it I've ever seen in my life. Like a real quick ramp down of both sound and vision that then led to Kermit at the curtains.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that I had seen all the runners talking about Lullaby of Birdland up until that point, combined with the visual evidence of there's a big edit here, made me go, oh, wait, I actually need to go back home and finish this on DVD in order to find out what was going on.
Let's just jump into it.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the cold open later, since we're talking about this right now.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the first backstage segment.
Okay. Do we need to talk about Kermit and Fozzie in front of the curtain first?
Nope. We covered that in talking about
the fact that they're sharing responsibility for the episode.
Yep.
Kermit is letting me help plan tonight's show.
That's true, folks. He plans his parts and I plan the good parts.
Kermit!
Yep, moving right along. Future reference.
Got it.
Everyone's caught up. But yes, so the first backstage runner, Fozzie thanks Kermit for letting him help plan the show.
Mm-hmm.
The two pig doctors carry the screaming thing backstage. And on Disney Plus, that's where it ends. It is 10 seconds long.
So it makes it seem like that's the punchline.
Yep.
We get to see that the screaming thing survived.
And then it cuts to Kermit introducing Don Knotts' first segment.
Is the fade as noticeable?
It's a hard cut, so it makes it seem like it's one of their blackout sketches.
Okay. So at this point, while you're watching it on Disney Plus, you didn't even notice that that was a truncated bit.
I thought it was weird, but I paid it no mind otherwise.
So the next backstage bit is Floyd approaching Fozzie saying, "My main bear, what it is." And because the main backstage segment that's established in the cut part of the earlier scene is that Floyd comes to Fozzie and Kermit saying, "I want to talk to you about the big closing number, man. I see that you've got picked Lullaby of Birdland." And Kermit, used to Floyd being a representative of the Electric Mayhem when something has gone terribly wrong, is excited to be able to say, "Oh, I didn't have anything to do with this week, Floyd. That's Fozzie, who's hiding behind his clipboard and cowering."
Yep.
At which point Floyd then says, "Great choice. We love it. We're excited to do this." And for the rest of the backstage runner and the return of the talk spot,
yep,
we have Fozzie and Floyd interacting about Floyd basically inducting him into being cool.
Mm-hmm.
That he's made such a good choice, the band wants to reach out and show how cool he is. Is there any of the next backstage bit where that happens? The giving him the sunglasses, talking about how much he's honored, is that in there at all?
That is, but it starts later.
Because it opens with the idea of,
"We're so pleased with your choice of the final number." It just starts with Floyd saying, "We're going to present you these sunglasses because you're
a fully registered hip dude."
Yeah. So that section is 12 seconds shorter. First backstage runner on the DVD is 1:11. Disney Plus is 10 seconds. The second backstage runner, DVD is 44 seconds. Disney Plus is 31.
Okay.
Otherwise, everything after that, there.
Which I suppose is necessary because you've got to establish the sunglasses for Fozzie's continued blindness, which shows up in the talk spot and the final credits.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you didn't establish Floyd giving him that and inducting him into the Coolness Society, that would be utterly mystifying.
Yeah.
But you have to excise mentions of Lullaby of Birdland. Apparently seems to be the rule of thumb.
Yep.
Okay. The next backstage bit is Fozzie saying that he's wearing the sunglasses and he's responding to Rolf and the puppy saying, "That sounded lovely." And this happens in between Rolf and the Swedish Chef.
This one's just not on Disney Plus at all.
Also,
yeah,
with this third backstage runner bringing back a long-running bit that we have.
Yeah.
Because Fozzie compliments two people who we didn't see what their act was. So there are more acts that we didn't see this episode, besides if you're a Disney Plus watcher. Mm.
But at the same time, they are coming from on stage, and he, because he's wearing the shades, doesn't realize that it's not Rolf and the puppy. But they couldn't have been another act. Who knows who these people are? They're Whatnot Muppets that I've never seen before. They could be audience members.
It's true.
Just wandering around.
Floyd tells Fozzie that one of the members of the band wants to shake his hand.
Mm-hmm.
Animal comes out, tackles Fozzie to the ground, and stomps on him four times. Four hits, 5 through 8.
Fozzie ends the bit by saying, "I didn't know it hurt to be hip." And then we have the Swedish Chef.
One last thing to mention about the Swedish Chef.
Yeah.
Not on Nickelodeon.
Bizarre.
Yep. So lots of edits this episode.
Lots of edits for various audiences. But the next backstage bit, as you say, is, I'm assuming, is totally gone.
Yes. I was wrong. The backstage four is on there. I was looking at the Fozzie's intro of the final number is not on Disney Plus.
Which wouldn't be if there's no final number.
Yeah.
So the whole thing of Floyd saying, "Hey, Fozzie, my Fuzzy, everything is everything."
On Disney Plus, Floyd asks Fozzie how it feels to be an official hoop dude. Fozzie says it's wonderful. He just wishes it came with a flashlight. It fades to black there.
That's right. That's the very awkward fade.
Yeah. And then comes up on Kermit on the outro. So yeah, it's 57 seconds on the DVD. It's 19 seconds on Disney Plus.
A solid 2/3 of that sketch missing.
Yeah. From a minute 11 to 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
44 to 31. Backstage 3 is not there at all, which is like 37 seconds. 38 seconds. Backstage 4, 57 down to 19. Fozzie's intro is 22 seconds, not on Disney Plus. Lullaby of Birdland is almost 2 minutes exactly, not on Disney Plus. And then the closing also has an edit on Disney Plus. It's a minute and 3 seconds on the DVD to 58 seconds on Disney Plus. Wild edits all over the place.
Well, let me tell you this about Lullaby of Birdland.
Mm-hmm.
It's a 1952 jazz standard that was composed by British jazz pianist George Shearing for the owner of the Birdland Club in New York City. And they agreed to split the rights on it.
Uh-huh.
One of them got the writing credits, and the other one got the distribution credits. And I believe it's the owner of the Birdland Club in New York City has the rights to the distribution of it. And I think that credit situation must have been what lent itself to this weirdness, that because there were two parties and one of them owned the song, but the other one owned the ability to control recordings of the song, that must have been where the sticking point was.
Yeah, it makes total sense.
We'll talk about the actual song when we do the Don Knotts segments. And so I'll bring up the song again then in terms of its performance of it. Because we'll talk about the music when we talk about the performance of the music.
Well, let's circle back to Don Knotts then, because we've gone through all the backstage bits that don't have anything to do with him. The first Don Knotts segment is
the backstage opening of the cold open, where Scooter comes in.
I was going to skip it this time. So proud of you. I was scrolling through my notes to find the first sketch. Oh, Ben, I'm so happy.
Where Scooter comes in and gives us the longest time so far, and significantly different in this first production episode, says 45 seconds to curtain, Mr. Knotts.
25 seconds to curtain.
Interesting. I'll trust your ears over and your subtitles over mine.
Uh-huh. And my
calculation of how long this
pretty sketch. Close counting of the time calculations, so therefore me being pretty happy with it. If it was 45 seconds, I'd be very mad right now. I mean, 25 seconds is still, I think, the longest one we've seen so far.
I think the longest up until this point has been 18.
Yeah. I was with you as you were introing it, being like, he's right, this is the longest.
Until I went in order of magnitude into the ludicrous zone. Don Knotts is hiding behind the makeup table in the backstage segment, Scooter walks all the way into the room to say what's going on. And Knotts is scared and irritated because he says, nobody told me I was going to have to share a dressing room. And when Scooter says, well, didn't they tell you about her? He is additionally shocked at the idea that what we can see poking up from behind the screen in the dressing room is the large plumes of a dancer's headdress. And so for him to be shocked that he is sharing the room with a her, based on that costume, is a little ludicrous. And who pokes their head over the screen to reveal themselves?
Good old Gorgon Heap,
who apparently we've been misgendering all this time.
Sorry, Gorgon.
Well, we'll see if that gender continues in future appearances by Gorgon.
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised with this because my notes say this could be dicey. But I feel like the misgendering fear that he has isn't due to, like, transphobic issues. It's purely he just didn't expect to be sharing a dressing room with a monster. I don't think the gender
is an additional level of discomfort.
Yes. It's just
surprise.
Yeah.
Gorgon's line is,
what's the matter, sweetie? You don't like Chorus Girl?
Which I think is hilarious. And then Scooter and Knotts both do a take to camera.
So as we litigated, Scooter says 25 seconds to curtain, and the cut to curtain is 31 seconds in, but the episode starts 7 seconds in on the DVD. So it's 24 seconds total, which is close.
The next time we see anything that has to do with Don Knotts is the curtain bit that happens after the first backstage segment where Fozzie and Kermit have been finding out about Lullaby of Birdland and Floyd and the Mayhem's relationship with it. And Kermit leaves that conversation to go out in front of the curtain to say the weird phrase,
okay, right now, gang, it's time for something good to happen.
Yeah, that is weird.
Kermit, have some faith in your own productions. You want the audience on your side.
Well, Kermit did say that he planned the good parts.
Yes.
So maybe he's calling back to that line to say, this is one of mine. I did the good parts.
And he is welcoming the very relaxed Mr. Don Knotts.
In Beast of the Week.
Don is apparently running some sort of children's program. He's standing in front of a set of large blocks with different animals painted on the sides. And he says that it's the program that presents the most hideous, repulsive, and disgusting animals for you sweet kids.
He's showing off a cute baby animal who's been taken away from his mother.
It's a brown, furry puffball with antenna feathers coming out of the top of its head. Oh. Mostly big eyes and fur and a mouth.
It's cute. It's in a cage, but it very quickly escapes that cage.
Which is what starts Don going from being children's presenter to scared bug-eyed man.
Yeah.
The fact that it squeezes itself out of the cage, which he says, I was told that that was escape-proof. And so things are already starting to go wrong.
It then crawls on his shoulder and licks his ear, but then bites him.
Well, it goes to a globe that's on end of the desk, and he comments that they're roughly the same shape. No, they're not.
They're both round-ish.
They're both round-ish. Yes, it's round. The globe is definitely round.
Yeah.
The fuzzball is squashed. It might have been round at some point.
The globe is round, but the earth is flat.
Okay, now who are we trying to get to listen to the podcast?
Well, considering that last reference was cut out,
then this one will be very weird. It knocks the globe off the table, and when Knotts goes around the desk to pick up the globe, that's when it jumps from the blocks onto him and starts going up his lab coat and then starts nuzzling his neck and getting into it. Yeah, you were right. We probably didn't need any of that.
Well, we did need it a little bit.
Because?
Don hits himself once.
Okay.
Because
when it's underneath his coat and he's squirming around.
Yeah, it's biting him, which we can't see, and I don't count bites. And so he goes to hit it to stop it from biting him, but it moves. He punches himself.
It then sort of seems like it's calming down a little bit. He grabs it, and it's now transitioned into just being a squirmy lump of, well, a non-squirmy lump of fur that he's animating by sort of twitching his fingers underneath it to make it look like it's still being puppeteered.
But it's just him squeezing it. It's
definitely him just squeezing it. Then he says we need to get it back to its mother, having established earlier that this was born in captivity and its mother has never been far from it before.
And then Mean Mama busts out of the desk and destroys the set.
Yeah, a good lingering moment on Dawn in the destroyed set after the huge, hairy, mouthed, bear-like thing that is Mean Mama grabs its tiny fluffball offspring from his hands and just, like, walks off set. It definitely stays with and gives Dawn a little bit more of a...
that reaction shot that Don Knotts is famous right. for, of going, huh? Then Statler and Waldorf comment on how great a performer Don Knotts is.
Mm-hmm. Waldorf says he sure is. When's he going to be on?
Statler says he just was on.
Waldorf asks if he liked his performance.
Yeah, you laughed like crazy.
I don't know why precisely, but that specific closer I think is hilarious.
I know why you like it so much, because we've witnessed that exact interaction in the recent past. To bring up more family members, Dan has definitely said that before to Missy when Missy has described something like a movie they watched. Mm. And I have heard Dan say, oh, did I like that? And she went, yeah, you laughed like crazy. Witnessing or watching this made me go, yeah, I've seen...
I've seen this, the very interaction.
This exact exchange.
The next time we get a Don Knotts bit is just after the UK spot. And as I mentioned, we have returned to, as far as I know, the last time, the TalkSpot set. And we have Don in the crook of the L-shaped wall mm-hmm. in the big empty space waiting for Fozzie to show up. And because Fozzie is wearing the shades that have been given to him by Floyd, he's crashing around backstage because he can't see anything through the dark lenses. Don says, why don't you take them off? Fozzie says, look, I've always wanted to be hip. I'm not going to give it up now.
Don says that he's hip too, and then he does this weird sniffing thing that's off-putting and disturbing.
I always wanted to be hip.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, personally, I've never had that problem.
Yeah.
Well, you know how it is. When you got it, you got it. I mean, when you're hip, you know what I mean?
Welcome to number three in Subtitle Watch. It is a sniff. It's a... I'm basically elevating my nose. I'm being snobbish. That's what he's getting at. He's wearing a very 70s outfit with mm-hmm. a big collar and an open, no top button opening to the shirt. And so he's doing snobbish coolness. And so he's sniffing.
But he's also like rubbing his nose. Mm-hmm. Like it
could be a Coke thing.
Yeah. It was just, I mean, and this is the joke.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like it's in character for Don Knotts to do that.
Well, also, it's not cool. He's acting in the most uncool way, a pantomime of what a cool person might be, if he could physically pull it off, which he's physically not built to do.
Yeah.
Which is very funny. The subtitles say he's sniffling.
Yeah, not what he's doing.
No.
That's a different word.
It's a very different word.
But Don then, to prove his hipness, then pulls out his own set of shades out of his pocket.
Which are big, square-lensed with lime green frames around them. And then he discovers he also can't see anything.
Yeah, after they slap five successfully. And Fozzie commits pretty hard this entire time as to not being able to see. Don goes in and out of it. Because they do a successful high five, and then Don, like, flips a switch and is like, oh, does a Frankenstein walk.
I'm feeling the darkness in front of me.
Yeah, and then...
walks off stage to a crashing noise.
And then Fozzie hears the noise, goes to investigate, falls off stage at the same place.
There's been a runner in the backstage interactions between Floyd and Fozzie, which is that Fozzie has no idea about hip-cool lingo. Mm-hmm. Previously, when Floyd and Fozzie were talking, the bit that wasn't in the Disney Plus version is the line, "Everyone's so blown away by your suggestion." And Fozzie asks, confused by the phrase, "blown away, is that good?" Mm-hmm. So that's the introduction of the concept. But then he, similarly, as Floyd continues to use all sorts of flowery language about what's going on, Fozzie's always a step behind, basically confused as to, is he being complimented? Is he being laughed at? Are these at all phrases he should know? In this, when Don says, "give me five," Fozzie doesn't know what that means.
Whatever, all right, yeah!
I thought it was pretty out there for Fozzie to be confused by the phrase "blown away," which is a phrase I have no etymological history of in terms of, was that common in 1977? Was that only the purview of the crazed teenagers from the Don Johnson movie? Yeah. I don't know. But for him to also not know what giving five was felt like extreme ignorance.
Yeah.
Funny, but extreme.
So we're about to talk about Lullaby of Birdland, mm-hmm. but Fozzie introduces Lullaby of Birdland. We didn't talk about that introduction.
By walking out in shades, having earlier been still wearing the shades and not knowing who came off the stage in the Rolf bit, he then walks on stage facing the wrong direction with his back to camera and audience, and says, because he's now trying to get the groove. He's in the previous backstage segment with Floyd and Kermit, said,
"I will introduce this number for my hip brothers, Green Stuff. Hey, hey!"
Yeah, Bear has wigged out.
So Fozzie has gone from being clueless about slapping hands to now fully appropriating his cool lingo in a hilariously cool dad sort of way, mm-hmm. which Kermit is so confused about that he says, "The bear has wigged out," I believe. So now he's very excited to introduce to his hip brothers and his swinging sisters the Lullaby of Birdland, but he's facing the wrong direction. The curtains open and it's revealed who the replacement bass player is. It's Don Knotts. Floyd makes this explicit with dialogue, saying, "You must be the new bass player." Knotts says, "How did you know that?" And Floyd says, "Oh, it was just a shot in the dark," which makes it seem like it's supposed to be another blind sunglasses joke, but it doesn't quite land.
They ask him if he can play, and Don Knotts says he can because he can read sheet music. Then he knocks a whole bunch of those sheets off the music stand.
Dr. Teeth counts down in Spanish.
I also liked to set the stage that this isn't going to go well. Mm. Dr. Teeth clearly doesn't respect people who need to read sheet music because he says, "Oh, he can read dots."
Well, he says sheet music. I haven't seen that stuff for years.
Yeah.
But then he says the cat can follow the dots. I thought the cat can follow the dots was respectful. Like, that to me sounded like he knows what he's doing. But the sheet music itself seemed like that's not a thing that we in the mayhem pay attention to.
Yeah.
That was the surprise, is, oh, you're gonna do this music the way it's supposed to be played?
This isn't gonna go well, then.
But that, curiously, isn't what happens, because they're all playing the song, Knotts isn't playing it correctly, and they hear almost instantly that something is going wrong. So despite the fact that he should be following along with the music, as he claims, they're all playing in sync and playing the song recognizably, and he's sawing away at one single note using a bow on the bass, and it is not the tonic of the chord.
It is Don Knotts the tonic.
Hey!
Yeah, they realize within the first 10 seconds, because
that's when the music stops.
Yep.
He says, "I think you need to get rid of the bow." Well, he starts with the marvelous phrase, "What in the pluperfect past tense is that?" Mm-hmm. Which is one of the most Walt Kelly phrases they've used in a long time.
Thanks for stealing one of my moments. But it's too good to not mention, which is why I'm not surprised with that. Yeah, so Don then throws the bow off.
Mm-hmm.
Which, it's a good thing he threw that bow and not Burlington Birdie from Bow.
No, he should have thrown off that, too. Of all the things that should have been cut from that episode, it was the American cut of getting rid of the UK spot that I most approve of.
Nope, it's a good UK spot. I stand by it.
They then count in German.
Mm-hmm.
And he's plucking the one note instead. But first, he's almost doing nothing.
Yeah.
But he says, you know, actually join in. And then he's encouraged by Floyd to play even faster. And then he says, this isn't a wedding, man. Play faster. And he's playing the one note over and over again, faster and faster and faster, until the bass explodes.
And Don Knotts is wearing a suit and then is left in a singed dressing gown.
Well, he's wearing long John underwear under the suit. Because, classically, when you're out on stage under the lights, it's freezing. Nobody ever talks about sweating it out under the lights.
Nope, not at all.
And so you
famously cold under the lights.
You need as many layers as possible. Animal says how much he loves that, and that is the end of the sketch.
So, Ben, you said you had more information about Lullaby at Birdland?
I wanted to say, I think the most famous recording of this is a heavily orchestrated version that's done by Ella Fitzgerald. But it's interesting to listen to, there's a just piano and bass recording of this that was done by Shearing late in life. And when you compare it to this version of it, which is Dr. Teeth and Floyd on vibes and Don Knotts on bass, having a real performance by the original composer that's just piano and bass is actually pretty close to what this should have sounded like.
Mm-hmm.
And stripped down as a jazz number, it sounds great. Whereas the version of it that gets started and interrupted and started and interrupted and then is sort of shouted over was almost unrecognizable.
Mm-hmm.
To be completely honest, I'm not sure that the rights holder of this needed to have worried.
Hmm. That's not what I thought you were going to talk about.
Which was?
Lullaby of Birdland does exist on Disney Plus.
In what form?
It's sampled in Menomina. In part of the improvised scat that Menomina is doing, he does a part of Lullaby of Birdland.
Where did you learn that?
On the Muppet Fandom Wikia.
Huh, so you're saying that the somebody thinks that that lines up with the melody of Lullaby of Birdland.
Yep, or maybe it's referenced in one of Jim's notes or something like that, that's the inspiration for that scatting. But, yep, supposedly that is Lullaby of Birdland.
Hmm.
So they snuck that by him, I guess.
I can't hear it. I'm not saying they're wrong.
I don't know that song, so.
Yeah. In the hour and a half prior to recording this, I had Lullaby of Birdland firmly stuck in my head from having done the research on it. Running Menomina through my head right now does not evoke that chorus at all.
I don't know. I don't know music. I'm now on the Menomina page to see if there's a reference for it there. But
you know what? I'm now worried about excerpting Love by Birdland
for this
for the podcast.
On the Menomina page, on the Muppet Show episode 101, the last line is, this version of the sketch includes a brief excerpt from Lullaby of Birdland performed in scat.
I remain dubious.
I don't blame you. I'm just reporting on what I've
researched. Yeah.
And this may be a source quoting a source quoting itself type of situation.
That latter page definitely feels that way, that they put it in the other entry and therefore they went and put it in the entry that it's referring to create a self-fulfilling circle.
I wish I could quote Windmills of the Mind right now.
Like a circle in a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel.
Yeah, that's the one. If only we didn't have to talk about the closing, because that would be the perfect way to end this episode. Because it came full circle.
But that would mean that the episode is never ending nor beginning, like an ever-spinning reel.
I mean, it seems like it. We joked that this one was going to be pretty quick, and it has not been.
I'm Ben.
I'm Pete.
And welcome back to this episode that's already in progress, where we're going to talk about the final curtain call of the Don Knotts episode, which aired 45 years ago today, November 28th, 1977.
Kermit says that's it for another show. Thanks Don for being on the show.
Well, first he thanks Fozzie for being his co-host. And Fozzie comes out and his sunglasses and walks off stage. While he's doing that and feeling his way forward, he goes,
hoo-ha, hello, hello.
Pete, do you remember previously talking about Fozzie saying hoo-ha?
No.
It was in the Lena Horne episode.
Yeah, I definitely don't.
In the talk spot, when Kermit and Lena Horne are talking, Fozzie interrupts their conversation with what I thought was bizarre at the time, the strange phrase going, hoo-ha, hoo-ha.
I do remember that now.
And what's hilarious about that is Fozzie was complaining that only Kermit got to talk to the guest.
Mm-hmm.
In the conclusion to the running segment of Fozzie and Kermit sharing parts, introducing things.
And also, Fozzie did talk to the guest in the talk spot this right. episode.
Fozzie then, for the first time since then, uses the phrase. It has not occurred at all since season 1, episode 11, and now season 2, production episode 1.
Airing 11th episode.
You're not wrong.
Circle after circle, windmill in my mind.
I won't tell you when, but the phrase, hoo-ha, comes back at least twice in this season.
Ooh.
So maybe something to keep track of. There are two other things that took place during the Lena Horne talk spot. There were two nice nices and will you get out of here? Yep. So that was a nexus point of verbal tics.
On Disney Plus,
mm-hmm.
and well, let's finish talking about what happens here, and then I'll tell you what happens on Disney Plus.
Okay. After Fozzie walks off stage and then comes back on, they say, and also we want to thank our special guest, who also comes out wearing the shades that he threw off his face in Lullaby of Birdland. And then Floyd comes in to say that the band has voted to permanently and irrevocably de-shade them.
Don tells Fozzie not to worry, that it's okay, because Square is beautiful, because his shades are square, and also so is he.
Mostly the second.
Yeah, but I don't think it's a coincidence that his shades were squared. Mm.
And upon that, Kermit then says, with all that, thanks very much, and we'll see you next time.
On Disney Plus, the mentioning the disaster of the closing number is not there. And it just re-picks up with Floyd saying, we're going to de-shade you.
So there's a missing segment in the middle of that interaction, which is an unbroken shot.
Yes, there is a left-to-right wipe.
So wild!
Yeah.
That is the craziest edit. I have to assume that the people at Disney Plus were tearing their hair out being like, what do we do? What do we do?
Yeah.
And only had bad solutions.
It goes, Fozzie comes out, falls off the stage. Don comes out, says, thank you, Kermit, wherever you are. And then a left to right screen wipe happens. Floyd is suddenly on stage. Fozzie says, yeah. And then Floyd de-shades Fozzie.
Fozzie responds to something that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Like, there's a split second where you catch the end of a line, but the first thing you can clearly hear is Fozzie going, yeah.
Oh, those poor people must have just been so frustrated by this experience.
In scrubbing through the episode, when I was doing my Disney Plus cut timing today, the UK spot, which is normally the exact halfway point, 13-ish minutes into a 26-minute episode. It's 13 minutes in, and it's two-thirds of the way through the scrub bar, because this episode is only 21 minutes long. And I was like, oh, wow, that's so weird to see. Because, yeah, the first time I watched this, there's, yeah, 7 minutes after the UK spot, and it just flies by. Like, it went so quickly that I was like,
what happened?
Yeah, what? I mentioned in that first backstage segment, I didn't notice that there was something wrong. It just seemed like it was a blackout. But as the episode went on and on, I was like, something's not right here.
I think if I had been watching the Disney Plus version, I would have been formulating all sorts of possibilities of how much was this two episodes squished together, or how much was the editor's scissors in effect here, in terms of they must have just tried to salvage something.
Yeah, if it wasn't for that left to right wipe in the closing, I would have been like, that's weird, but I might not have known something was wrong.
Right.
But that was when I went, oh, this episode's been tampered with.
Yeah,
I need to go find out why. And then, yeah, the Wikia told me why, and I went, well, DVD's going in for watch number two. So very cleanly, let's move into numbers, because I've been talking about them all the time.
Absolutely.
Music-wise, there was 10 minutes and 18 seconds worth of music in this episode, which in the Disney Plus version would be 48.14%.
But wait, is that including Lullaby of Birdland?
Oh, that would be including Lullaby of Birdland. Yeah, I forgot to take that out. So in terms of music, the Disney Plus version had 9 minutes and 7 seconds of music out of 21 minutes for 43.42%. Including Lullaby of Birdland back in and increasing the rest of the episode runtime, the DVD version has 10.11 minutes or 10 minutes 18 seconds for 39.52% music. Because Lullaby of Birdland was barely a minute's worth of music.
Because it cut in and out.
Yeah.
So even though the sketch was about 2 minutes long,
it was only a minute worth of music.
Okay.
I'm going to use final stats based off of the original episode, not the Disney Plus version. So yeah, the official log is going to be 39.52% music, which is in the low-ish.
It's in the bottom third, but it's not really as low as it seemed.
Yeah.
Exactly. Because this episode felt, in the DVD version, it felt like there was very little music. And yeah. So for it to have actually been that much is a surprise to me.
Yeah. Sweet Gingerbread Man was over 2 minutes. What a Wonderful World was over 2 minutes.
I think that was longer than I realized.
It's a slow, boring song with a dog that has had some things done to it. There were 8 hits and 1 explosion in this episode. No human Muppet kisses. As for ranking, I kind of wrestled with this one because I didn't hate it, but I also didn't like it. Like, I didn't love Beasts.
Compared to, for example, the telethon for the monsters in the cages.
Right. Yep. Which I really liked.
It didn't have the same manic energy. Mm-hmm. And in part, that's because Don Knotts is a very, very different performer to Dom DeLuise. And so you don't want them to hit the exact name notes.
True.
But at the same time,
it was underwhelming.
I agree. And I think that Knotts does a good job playing awkward. I thought he was great in the talk spot. And he's introduced as somebody who is scared and anxious. But that isn't really what he played in response to this particular mini monster. He played nervous, but not scared. And for a thing that was mostly eyes and mouth, I thought that it was going to, A, be more vicious, and he was going to be more twitchy about it. And neither of those things happened.
Yeah. And also, you know, one of my big things is connecting with the Muppets.
Yeah.
And so this was just one Muppet. It wasn't emotional. His interactions with Fozzie are one or both of them can't see each other. And as I mentioned earlier, Don is very inconsistent with whether he can or can't see through the things where Fozzie is solidly committed to it. And Lullaby of Birdland, it was fun, but also the way Don Knotts plays the bass infuriated me, which goes back to what you brought up at the beginning of the episode of his lack of musical ability. Yeah, it's blatantly obvious in that, but also you can pretend a little more. You can change that note. He just leaves it open and just plucks it faster. He never once presses one of the notes, even though his hand is on the board. I didn't like it. So I rated him 23rd.
Wow. I was going to guess 18.
No, that's where Teresa Brewer is.
Uh-huh.
But I was going through and I was like, well, so he's lower than both Edgar Bergen and Steve Martin. That was
which tough. You left open. You deliberately didn't put Steve Martin at the bottom for just this purpose.
Yeah. I almost put him at 21 above Steve, but I was like, no, Steve's bits, even though I didn't care for them and they weren't really Muppet related, so-and-so, when he was talking to the Muppets, he was talking to the Muppets. Mm-hmm. And Don Knotts wasn't. So 23rd. So there's one spot available. So they could both bump down one if I don't find something worse, but sorry, Don.
As always, we close the episode by focusing on some positive notes. Talking about our 5 favorite moments of the episode. A moment is an aspect of production, of writing, of performance that we want to highlight. And before we draw the episode to a close, Pete, why don't you start with one of your top 5?
For our first moment, I want to bring up the screaming thing again. Specifically in the Statler and Waldorf segment. When it runs into their box, there is a brief pause before it jumps over the ledge, mm-hmm. where clearly the puppeteer was getting its arm out of the puppet so it could toss itself over the ledge.
For any British listeners, that's not what that phrase meant.
Yes. Nope. And that pause before the leap and then the way it's thrown over the edge made me laugh so hard. So that's my first moment.
Yeah. It didn't occur to me that that pause was due to physical production reasons. So that's very perceptive of you.
Because it's going so fast and it stops and then launches itself over. It's so good.
For my first, our second moment of the episode, I want to talk about, in the Lullaby of Birdland section, when Dr. Teeth is so amazed at the fact that Don Knotts is both using the music, but also cool enough to be able to follow all those dots.
We're going to lay down a little Lullaby of Birdland on this cornball show. Can you dig it?
Can I dig it? I got the music right here, man.
Sheet music. I haven't seen that stuff for years.
Both Floyd and Dr. Teeth are, in my opinion, very interesting Muppets in the way in which they have unique eye mechanisms. Floyd is apparently wearing sunglasses, but his eyes are tubes which can squish and squint.
I noticed that for the first time this episode. I don't know if it's the first time he's done it.
But Dr. Teeth has eyelids that are sunglasses. He literally has translucent blue plastic that cover the tops of his eyes, and when he wants to look surprised or amazed, it goes back into his hairline and hides itself. And it's a simple thing for a Muppet to look surprised. All it has to do is widen its eyes, or in Dr. Teeth's, those sunglasses have to disappear. But there was something childish and amazed in the fact that his eyes went so wide with, I haven't seen that stuff for years, that just made me, he's not even in the foreground of the shot. He's hidden in kind of a nook of negative space behind the base, but it's just all eyes and camera angle of Jim knowing exactly where to put him so that his reading of that line and his shock at somebody needing to read music to play with the mayhem, I don't know, it really jumped out at me and I loved it a lot.
For my second moment, our third moment, the middle moment, I would like to talk about something Floyd says to Kermit. Mm. In the first backstage segment, after the two pig doctors carried screaming thing passed.
So a thing that you didn't see the first time around.
Correct. So maybe this is one of the reasons why I liked it so much, because it was such a surprise to me the second time I watched it when it was all brand new. And I was like, oh, there's more here? Floyd's opening line to Kermit is,
okay, green thing, the band has asked me to have a word with you.
And it made me laugh so much that either Floyd doesn't respect Kermit enough to call him by his name, or more likely doesn't know Kermit's name.
Floyd's all hopped up on dog drugs, and he is liminally connected to identity and reality.
Recognizes Kermit is green and a thing, and calls
not
him...
Not screaming.
Not screaming, no. And refers to him by his name, Green Thing.
His description through his limited perception.
Through his shade eyes.
I, in general, thought that Floyd was great this episode. He does the keep on truckin' walk at least three times, and in general carries those backstage segments with his overwritten weirdly purple prose. But I agree that his fundamental disdain of Kermit is a great through line. For my penultimate moment, the fourth moment, my second moment, I'm going to talk about costume design. I thought that Don Knotts' costume design was wonderful.
Yes.
He's got four major outfits that I can think of. Each one is very distinct, weirdly colorful, great choices, but specifically the way in which he's wearing his creepy, slinky 70s outfit during the talk spot, and then he's wearing his cool man jazz outfit during Lullaby of Birdland. I already talked about the super popped collar, but the material in the talk spot is very much polyester-tastic mm-hmm. in terms of how much it helps underscore how uncool he is when he thinks he's pretending to be cool. As much as the sniff helps and as much as his weird facial expression helps, his outfit does an enormous amount of heavy lifting. And similarly, where he's trying to fit in with the Electric Mayhem in Lullaby of Birdland, and he's wearing the same green shades that he put on during the talk spot that don't go at all with his fantastic I'm trying to be a cool jazz man outfit, which is a gray pinstriped blazer that's just a little bit too big over a black button-down shirt with a purple tie and a black fedora with a purple hat brim. It's a great Halloween jazz musician slash pimp outfit, and I was here for it. Except for the hat, I could wear that outfit tomorrow. I unfortunately don't look like Don Knotts, and so it
but would, you can play the bass better.
I mean, I also have that prop. Yes, would me playing it cause it to blow up? Maybe. It's been untouched for several years, so God only knows how ready to be destroyed that instrument is.
How friction sensitive it will be.
Yeah, and also the weird horizontal stripes in the shirt that he wears at the end. Like, he's doing a lot, but he's also doing a lot because he's using his outfits to subliminally also make his characters funnier. And whether that was his choice in that we've talked about with Candy Bergen and a couple of other guests that they took them shopping in London prior to filming in order to have them have something that was now, or whether that was the costumer for The Muppet Show just having the best ways of making us additionally appreciate his character choices, it deserved to be highlighted.
Mm-hmm. For my final moment, our final moment, the final moment of the episode, I started by talking about the screaming thing. I'm going to end by talking about the screaming thing. I love the screaming thing.
Pete, it's almost like you're circling back to your first moment, like a circle in a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel.
Maybe I did that intentionally. And in Vet's Hospital, Dr. Bob tickles the screaming thing's feet at the end and says, tickle, tickle. And the screaming thing laughs and says, no, no tickle. And I liked it.
So you're saying that what you enjoyed was abuse and lack of consent. That's your final note for the episode.
No. No, not let's not end there. And also, for the record, no. I'm more highlighting the tickle tickle, but I didn't want to not mention that screaming thing does say no, no tickle. Which I just ended with again. So again, tickle, tickle.
But he then very stops.
Funny. It fades to black.
So we don't
know. Yeah, we don't
know. We don't know what happens. He could be tickling
him to this day. Even though we later see Rolf also abusing a dog. Oh no.
Rolf, you're a monster.
Oh no. What have we done?
And see.
This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design, such as it is, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. Music in the episode comes from archive.org and archival Henson Associate clips of Silver and Cones, Yes, We Have No Bananas. Under what we sure hope is transformative fair use, because we don't want this episode to be cut by Disney Plus.
You can find us at farceperspective.com and follow us on Twitter at @FarstNameBasis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan Emily and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic phenomena.
All excerpts in this podcast are used for the purposes of review. There are things, dates, facts, names, synonyms for circular objects, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect. Please contact us via the website, and we'll post it to our errata page on farceperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete, my co-host is Ben,
hoo-ha,
and we'll, within a wheel, see you next week when we discuss Season 2, Production Episode 23, guest starring John Cleese. Yay!